The next case is case number 68880, in re discipline of Geraldine Kirk Hughes. We have Ms. Hughes. And Ms. Isaacson. And Mr. Hunterton's here too. Ms. Hughes.
Good morning. Geraldine Kirk Hughes appearing on behalf of myself. I have practiced law in this jurisdiction for more than 30 years. And I find myself, after advocating for my clients for 30 years, I find myself before this court this morning advocating on behalf of myself. But the issue before this court just does not affect myself. It affects all other similarly situated attorneys. And more importantly, it affects the privacy of my current clients and future clients. It is my position today that my constitutional rights were violated, as well as my due process rights. And my authority for my position, for my appeal, is, of course, all the pleadings on file herein, and more importantly, the Nevada Constitution, the Nevada Financial Privacy Act of 1977, as codified in NRS 239A, NRS 2.120, O'Connor versus State of Nevada, Nevada Supreme Court Rule 110, and Brown versus Sheriff of Hobart County. I want to start with recognizing first that the Supreme Court has the absolute authority to regulate the practice of law. And they set forth rules for guidance to give the lawyers notice and for state bar if they're utilizing those rules for disciplinary matters. But those rules cannot be inconsistent with Nevada law. It cannot be inconsistent with the Constitution. 2.120 is very clear that this honorable court, although we have broad powers, it does not have the powers to violate the law. In 239A, it specifically set forth how an agency can acquire financial records via subpoena. It must provide service upon the customer, the bank customer. In this case before the court, that customer was myself. It was my account that they subpoenaed. They also subpoenaed my former client's accounts as well, and they provided no notice whatsoever to those clients that their constitutional rights were being violated. Now, NRS 239 does provide some provisions as to how a state agency can acquire records. State Bar simply didn't follow those provisions. And as such, as a citizen of this state, I am absolutely entitled to the protections afforded to 239A. That's afforded to every citizen of this state, including myself. Now, it is interesting to note that when Nevada adopted 239A, it was patterned after California's Privacy Act. And I provided to this court some of the legislative objections that was presented in California. And in California, the California State Bar sought to be exempt from having to comply with their Privacy Act. And that legislature said no. What is significant in this jurisdiction, I also pulled the history of our Privacy Act, Chapter 239A. And nowhere in it does our state bar, our board of governors, petition the government to be exempt. They did not. I saw an objection. Sure.
What effect, was there a stipulation to the admission of these documents at the hearing? And if so, what effect would that have on the argument you're making here?
As to the financial exhibit, it would have absolutely no effect. And I would refer you to (239A)090, which specifically states that I cannot waive the waiver, my protection under 239A. So even though my counsel, and I agree, my counsel at the time was Mr. Cherry, and on the record, he stipulated to the admission of these documents. But that stipulation was not valid. And it's valid, not valid for several reasons. I think both counsels understood that the state thought the state bar had lawfully obtained those financial records. You cannot stipulate to violate someone's constitutional right. You just cannot do that. I think there was a mutual mistake on behalf of both counsel. I think second, you can't stipulate to illegally inadmissible evidence. That cannot be done. And then again, my support is NRS 239-8090, invalidity of waiver.
Ms. Kirkhues, again, first of all, I know you represent yourself, and I'm speaking. It's hard to tell with the sound here, but and I certainly appreciate it. I know you're a good attorney. You've done many cases in front of me when I was a district judge, and I appreciate your good legal work you've done over the years here. But there's a lot of issues. If we get beyond the constitutional issues you've raised and get into the specifics, there's 35 pages of findings and conclusions from the hearing. Do you want to make any comment about the trust accounts issues? We have three different grievances here, so there's different issues with it, but the main grievance, the one about how the trust account was handled and distributions and the fact that it doesn't appear to any waiver of conflict was obtained pursuant to the rules of professional conduct. You want to discuss about any of those?
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address that. The complaint alleged conflict of interest as to Joseph King. It was always my position that Joseph King was not my counsel of record. And when the hearing panel switched and wanted to allege there was a conflict of interest between myself and Terry Drake, I attempted to address that. And if you look at the record, Mr. Caldwell, one of the hearing panel, stopped me and said, you cannot discuss anything that was said between you and your former clients because they're not the grievance and they did not waive their confidentiality. My position as to that particular claim is I received no notice that they were going to switch in the middle of the hearing to allege conflict of interest between my former client, Darlene Moore, or Terry Drake. Now, going on, the State Bar's defense that the whole Chapter 239 is inapplicable to them. It is my position that they are judicially stopped from making that particular argument because they run over to federal court, they've been running over to federal court for the last 40 years, claiming that they are the administrative arm, the investigative arm of this court, and as such, they're entitled to immunity. C. O'Connor versus State Bar of Nevada. And even in my case, when I went to federal court to seek protection from the use of these financial records, again, they claimed that they were arm of the judicial branch, the Supreme Court, and as such, federal court didn't have any jurisdiction, that my sole remedy was before the Supreme Court. When I first learned the extent of the breach of my constitution violation, was when State Bar filed a supplemental volume 8 in October of 2016. In the receipts, you will find at least a minimum of seven financial subpoenas that were served on banks. Not one of them was served on the unsigned. Now let's assume for a moment. That State Bar thought all it had to do was follow Rule 110. They didn't follow 110 here either. I asked the court to look at Rule 110. The first thing, the first bridge, in my opinion, is who can serve the subpoena. It is my position that State Bar and a hearing panel, and look at the structure of it, can issue a subpoena. In this particular case, the only signer on the subpoena was State Bar Counsel. Second, there's an admonition that's supposed to be placed on the subpoena that basically says you can contact the attorney who's subject of the investigation. Look at all subpoenas that's contained in the record of appeal, and I represent to you they're located at the record at ROA 746, ROA 7699, and my supplement to my third exhibit one to my third supplement brief, a supplement to my brief on the record. They intentionally left out on the subpoenas that the persons could contact me. That discourages any bank from complying with 239A. Any client that received those subpoena, that discourages those people from contacting me to let me know what's going on. Some of the subpoenas that were served on my own office. They were telling my own office staff they could not talk to me. And they did not talk to me because of the admonition that was placed on this. I meant to reserve 5 minutes.
Ms. Isaacson.
Good morning. My name is Janine Isaacson. I'm Assistant Bar Counsel with the State of Nevada, and I am here representing the State Bar. An attorney's license equals power. Power best described by the ABA standards of imposing lawyer discipline in the Court of Appeals of Maryland case as follows. Few vocations offer as great a spectrum of good and honorable works as does the legal profession. The attorney is entrusted with the life savings and investments of his clients. He becomes the guardian of the mentally deficient and the potential savior of the accused. He is the fiduciary.
Ms. Isaacson, in the matter that's being presented today, Ms. Hughes has outlined a number of things that she said the State Bar has violated her rights. Why not, in terms of the position she's taken, why has the State Bar not acted properly from her standpoint?
Respectfully, the arguments raised by Ms. Kirk-Hughes in her brief are by and large clearly disproved by the record on appeal. The main issues Ms. Kirk-Hughes
the subpoenas. Let's the last item mentioned. What do you say about that?
Yes, sir. The State Bar issued a number of subpoenas in this case, and we did so under SCR 110, which is the rule that has been set forth by the Supreme Court to govern our subpoena power. That rule was created through the Nevada State Legislature's Rule 7.275, which gave this court exclusive jurisdiction over the State Bar of Nevada, which was created as a regulatory agency to ensure that attorneys don't abuse their power. Each of the subpoenas in this case were issued pursuant to SCR 110. Now, Ms. Kirk-Hughes argues that the State Bar of Nevada is also subject to NRS 239A. We don't agree. First off, it would be contradictory to 7.275, in which the legislature clearly told the Nevada Supreme Court, when it comes to matters of regulating attorneys, you are responsible for the State Bar. You can tell the State Bar how they can oversee attorneys. Secondly, even assuming for a moment that we could be classified as a governmental entity under NRS 239A, there is a section in the statute 070, which talks about the inapplicability of that rule in many situations. And I would ask you to look at Section 6, which specifically states that the statute doesn't apply to regulatory agencies if authorized by law to examine, audit, or request reports of financial institutions. SCR 78.5 does exactly that. That particular law tells attorneys where they can bank. It tells attorneys what kind of accounts they can have. It tells attorneys what sort of documentation and accounting they need to keep. It tells attorneys how long they can keep it. And it tells attorneys, and most importantly, that the State Bar of Nevada can look at that information. The rule also requires banks to issue reports to the State Bar in the event accounts are overdrafted, the IOLTA accounts. And in Ms. Kirk-Hughes' case, she overdrafted both her Bank of America account and later the Wells Fargo account, both which resulted in subpoenas by the State Bar of Nevada to determine the potential harm to the public.
Bam, doesn't the bar have almost a higher obligation, you're prosecuting lawyers for not following the rules, to make sure that you're following all the rules to a T?
We do. I absolutely agree with that. And we take great pains to ensure that there's due process to all attorneys. For example, in this given case, the case at the time it was filed was not subject to the rules of disciplinary procedure, which are now in place. And even though we were 6 months before this trial started, because it was so large, because it involved so many issues, the state bar, they stamped and produced each and every page of its exhibits 1 through 15 to Respondents' Counsel William Terry 6 months before the trial ever started. That enabled Mr. Terry to go through the state bar's exhibits, and it is why we were able, prior to the hearing, to stipulate to the admission of the bank records, because he had had an opportunity to review all the information and make an informed decision that the documents were obtained appropriately.
Is it your position that you complied with 239A?
It is my position that 239A does not apply to the state bar pursuant to 239070, section 6.
Thank you.
Even if you wanted to assume that Ms. Kirkhues is not bound by her own attorney's stipulation to the bank records, after day two of the trial, Ms. Kirkhues came to the state bar and asked to personally look at all of the documents in the state bar's possession. We, of course, agreed, because she has a right to look at whatever we have. We let her come to the state bar. She spent a significant amount of time there and asked for copies of specific documents. One of the things she specifically...
Let me just return you for a moment to Justice Stiglitz's question. Did you cite 239.070 sub 6 in your answering brief?
I did not, madam, because Ms. Kirkhues raised that argument in her reply for the very first time. And the day the reply was served, the court closed the briefing. Under that rule, the state bar was not permitted to respond to that argument. If you look at her original opening brief, she does not reference NRS 239A.
Okay.
When Ms. Kirkhues was at the state bar, she specifically requested to look at all the subpoenas that were issued in this case. We gladly let her do so. She asked for copies of specific documents, and on day three of the hearing, she moved to put copies of these documents that she had obtained from the state bar herself in evidence. We stipulated to it, like we stipulated to every page of every document she wanted to use to defend herself, because we believe that lawyers should be able to defend themselves vigorously and to the best of their ability, and we don't want to impede them from doing so. The hearing continued for three more days, and Ms. Kirkhues never once raised any argument about any of the subpoenas issued by the state bar. The first time she did so, and the first time she raised any of these arguments at all, was in her briefing. In old Aztec Mine versus Brown, a point not raised below is waived on appeal. I submit to you this goes even further, given Ms. Kirkhues had knowledge of all of this information and chose to say nothing during the course of the hearing. Only did so upon appeal. Going to Ms. Kirkhues' other arguments, she also argues in her papers that her Sixth Amendment rights were violated because of the Confrontation Clause. She argues that the state bar should have brought somebody from the bank to testify about the foundation and the authenticity of the bank records. That argument flies in the face of the waiver. Because the records had been stipulated to, which I would cite you to volume 2, ROA, page 363, lines 17 through 24, Mr. Terry specifically stated, so you won't have any evidentiary issues on those things. Because there was a full stipulation to the evidentiary sufficiency of all those financial records, there would have been no need to call any witnesses to lay the foundation or to authenticate the bank records because it had already been done so via stipulation. Ms. Kirk-Hughes also argues that her 14th Amendment rights were violated because of the proposed sentence from the panel. Specifically, the panel recommended a 6-year suspension for Ms. Kirk-Hughes. That suspension was based on the 36 pages of findings that are cited more than 250 times to almost 10,000 pages of a record on appeal.
Is there any maximum suspension that can be ordered? Does it cap out at a certain number of years?
No, sir, it would be disbarment. Disbarment is the permanent sanction.
Right, so how many years can a suspension be? Can it be 20 years, 30 years? I mean, at some point in time, you know, I've never heard of a 6-year suspension, is the reason I'm asking.
There is no cap on it. It's my belief that the panel wanted to keep Ms. Kirk-Hughes from disbarment, but impose a sanction that they felt would protect the public. I know of another situation where a lawyer had a recommended sentence of 7 years, and that would be Mr. Jobian. The sentence that was recommended by the panel was done so because of what she did and because of all of the aggravating factors in this case. And the panel found numerous aggravating factors under 102.51. Specifically, they found that she had numerous prior disciplinary offenses, including a prior suspension. They found that she had a dishonest or selfish motive. They found that she had submitted false statements during the formal hearing proceedings, and this was in the form of a false accounting to basically hide the fact that she had taken the money for her own personal uses. And most importantly, throughout that entire hearing, Ms. Kirk-Hughes refused to acknowledge the wrongful nature of her conduct. Not once did she take responsibility for any of her actions, which were clear and unambiguous on the record. And I submit to you today, Ms. Kirk-Hughes still has no remorse for any of her actions. She argues that the prejudice to her in not getting the bank record subpoenas at the time is that because it robbed her of the ability to get the pending balances. And what she means by that is, although the monthly ending balance on a given month would show unequivocally that she had misappropriated the money belonging to Mr. Walker or Mr. Keene, there may have been one day in that month where another client's money had been deposited that would give the illusion that she had enough money in the account to pay what she owed to either of them. That argument in and of itself shows Ms. Kirk-Hughes does not understand or respect what an IOLTA account is supposed to be for. She doesn't understand that she can't use clients' money interchangeably as she wishes. She can't rob Peter to pay Paul. She can't use one client's money to cover what she owes to another one. And that, I submit to you, is dangerous.
Well, did Ms. Kirk-Hughes submit any testimony to the panel that explained why these withdrawals were made from the trust account and some sort of logical explanation why it would be proper under the Supreme Court rules and the rules of professional conduct?
I think the logicalness of her argument is somewhat subjective. In our opinion, it was not. She kept arguing that if she could have gotten the pending balances at the time the subpoena was issued, it would show that one day she had the money there, even if she didn't have it at the end of the month. And again, that argument goes to the fact that she thinks she can use somebody else's money to cover what she owes to another person who she didn't say keep the money for. The findings in this case are incredibly clear. Ms. Kirk-Hughes' rights were not violated, and we strongly urge this panel to impose the 6-year suspension recommended by the underlying disciplinary panel, which they reached after 5 days of hearing.
So you're not advocating for disbarment?
Your Honor, we may have in the underlying case, but I believe the panel has spoken, and we believe what they propose to be appropriate. Thank you.
Again, the state has conceded they didn't serve me with one notice of a subpoena. Had they done so, I would have been able to first move to quash the subpoena as it not being relevant, or to narrow the scope of the subpoena, or to request of the bank that they provide the pending balances as well. And let me tell you what the significance of that is, because opposing counsel seems to miss what happens in the personal injury industry. Oftentimes, you will see in my accounting that on the day I may have received the check for a client, I would have written out a check to that client for his portion. The check didn't get deposited until later that afternoon, but the banks sometimes hold a pending status for sometimes 5 days, sometimes 15 days. You cannot just go at the balance that's showing what was in the account. During the hearing, I gave him an example that I had deposited a $200,000 check from an insurance company, wrote the client out their portion of the check, but my bank account said I had $15,000 in it at that particular time. Now, what created that bounce check that one time after 30 years, what created the bounce check was, because of my illness, I forgot to deposit the check. I accepted the responsibility for having done that. I accepted a private reprimand. But the state bar used that instances to say they had probable cause to go and issue subpoenas for all my banking account. I asked you to look at the record, and it's at, that letter of reprimand was February 14th of 2012, before they even filed a complaint. So the screening panel had already issued out a punishment of a private reprimand. Why are they using that as a basis to go and subpoena my records? They sent out the subpoenas on February 16th. The screening panel had made the decision of the public reprimand on February 14th of 2012. So that was not probable cause for them to go searching through all of my financial records, my client's financial records. Had they followed the law, I would have been able to go to a court and say, this is not probable cause, because look at the hearing panel's decision. They've already decided this issue and disposed of it. I did not contest that. State Bar has not complied with the law, period. And by them not complying with the law, I was not given an opportunity to represent myself properly. Did I have counsel? Yes, I did. Why did he stipulate as to certain issues? I don't know. But he cannot stipulate to waive my constitutional rights. And as a matter of law, this court has an obligation to reconcile 110 with 239A. More importantly, look at the subpoena. Why is the state bar sending out notices throughout these bar proceedings that lasted over 5 years? Confidential subpoena, the rule said, once a formal complaint is filed, that's rule, Supreme Court Rule 105, it is no longer confidential. Why are you intimidating all of the other witnesses in this case by telling them they can't talk to me? Even the admonition under the rule doesn't say that. Look at the actual subpoenas that was issued. They do not comply with the law. And I would submit it.
Thank you, Ms. Eisen. Ms. Kirk Hughes, for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be recessed tomorrow.